GTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, vice president for community and government relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Good morning. This is a rebroadcast of an Education Matters program with host Jonathan Shaler.
Hello, this is Jonathan Shaler on WGTD-FM. I'm your host today for Education Matters, and my guest today is Professor Adrienne Viramontes. She's a professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and Adrienne has been a faculty member for the past 16 years and is the current department chair. She earned her bachelor's and master's degrees in communication from Purdue University, Calumet, is that correct, Adrienne?
Calumet.
Okay. In Hammond, Indiana, and went on to earn her PhD in speech communication from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. She specializes in the study of lived experience at the intersection of race, class, gender, sexuality, and geographic locale, and focuses on Mexican-American identities in the Midwest. The methods she regularly employs are autoethnographic, performative writing, and she's immersed in the area of phenomenology, the study of how things appear to us and how we come to understand particular phenomena. She also publishes work in the scholarship of teaching and learning. So welcome, Adrienne.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Oh, it's exciting to have you here. Full disclosure, Adrienne is my colleague at the university, and so I know her quite well, but it's a thrill to have this opportunity to just talk about what really matters to Adrienne, to you, Adrienne, regarding teaching, education. So I'm just going to dive right into that word phenomenology and ask you what that's about and what that has to do with your teaching.
Well, I would say that there's probably a couple of different areas of focus within phenomenology as an area of study. For some, it's the study of consciousness. And then for others, like myself, who are in communication and focus on that, I would say that it's the study of how things appear to us. And what that means is, so how do I understand myself as a woman? How do I understand myself as a Mexican person? How do I understand, you know, the concept of what marriage means to me? So how things appear in our lives and then collect meaning for us. Mm. And then that's how we sort of interact and intersect with them.
So you're focusing on both everyday lived experience and also the way we make sense of it?
Yes. So just as an example, when I was very young, my whole family is Mexican. When I was very young, I'm an only child. Don't hate me for that. People have a real issue with that. Anyway, when I was young, my mother passed away and I was sent to live with my very, very old fashioned Mexican grandparents who believed that it was their job in life to teach me how to be, quote, a proper Mexican girl. And those kinds of things just didn't speak to me at that time. And when I began to reject or not really perform those things well for my grandmother, she used to joke with me about how I must not be, quote, a real Mexican. And then this is how working class Mexican people talk to each other. But she would joke around with me about, you know, maybe inside clearly I was white and on the outside I just looked Mexican. And so again, as an eight-year-old, if you tell me these things on a regular basis, why would I not believe you? Mm. Why would I not think that there's something valid and real about what you're saying? And so how do I make sense of that? And so that's my example of the things that I study. So through your interactions, By the way, I thought I was white until I was 30. I mean, these things have real impacts on us. And if you never think about the things that you think you know about everything, including yourself, I think that life could be more complicated than is necessary.
Wow. Okay, so this is some deep territory, and I've got to ask a follow-up then.
Please.
So, are you saying that, do you think that race, just take race for a moment, is inherent or is it socially constructed?
I think it's, I don't know inherent in what, but I think it's two things simultaneously. And I love this topic. So it's a concept that, you know, historically humans have come up with in order to categorize and understand why humans of all kinds maybe look different, sound different, whatever the case may be. It's socially constructed, meaning it's not objectively real. However, it is very real because as we talk about it and interact with it, we respond to it. We respond to people who think about it as a real thing, whether it be a friendly thing or if they're angry about it for some reason. And we form judgments and assign meaning to it, not only for ourselves, but for others as well.
What do you, this reminds me of a PBS series called Race, the Power of an Illusion. And it also, what do you think of commentators like John McWhorter from the New York Times, he's African-American, he's a linguist, and he's conservative and he pushes back against this idea of critical race theory, and he's chimed in on the AP controversy in Florida with removing some authors, some of the more, he would say, left-leaning controversial authors from the curriculum. Where I'm going with this is his agenda seems to me in part to be about promoting progress in our overcoming racism and the traps that we fall into through race by shaking off the illusion, refusing to live within the illusion. And I don't know how you do that, but that seems...
I think that that sounds like a wonderful idea. And yeah. I guess I don't want to say the only problem, because who am I? I'm certainly no expert on any one given thing. You could argue, but I think that thinking, you know, whatever it is that you think about race, the fact of the matter is that there are power structures that shape all of our lives that we don't really have much control over. So I can say, well, I don't think of myself as Mexican. I'm just like everybody else. That might be an idea that works for me. But when I meet or interact then within a capitalist system or let's say just even a job interview context, they're going to ask me to fill out a form. I'm going to have to check a box that claims that my identity is this, and this for whatever reason. And whatever I think in my head now is intersecting with a structural reality that I can't really control, right? For all kinds of good reasons, we want to count people or we want to measure things. And since we now have all of these categories, those things are real. So are our ideas, but you have to sort of blend the two together at some point and figure out how you're going to negotiate your way through that. There are some, I was at, I don't know what conference I was at, but there was an African-American speaker who came, and his proposition was to move beyond the idea of race. And so it was very much the same idea as, you know, and again, I don't think that that's a bad idea. I'm sort of, I don't know what the right word is. I don't want to say fearful because that's a little bit too strong, but I want to anticipate the various responses that the structural world has to us, you know, trying to sort of forget about it. I mean, I think the ideal is intriguing, and I actually don't believe in identifying as colors. I think that that's weird that we do that. Mm-hmm. None of it's true. Nobody is actually black. Nobody is actually brown. Nobody is actually white. And sweet heavenly God, wouldn't that free a whole lot of people? And so I don't understand this weird relationship that we have with the words that are colors.
Mm. Okay, so I think we've gone pretty far into that direction. Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to switch directions for a minute and sure. ask more directly about teaching and learning. And okay. what it is that you teach at UW Parkside and what you're most passionate about?
The courses that I teach, there's a bunch of them. But regularly, or the most often, I teach what I would call a course in research methods, which includes theories of communication, and then setting up a research project for undergraduates to explore and really get an experience of what it is that academic people call knowing things.
Mm.
So mm. those courses I teach a Latinx, if you will, communication course. I also teach once in a while, I can't even remember now, it's been so long. I teach a bunch of things, but mostly I teach those classes. And then we teach at the grad level too,
right.
where I teach an autoethnography and a philosophy of communication course. Mm.
So many good things. Well, take any one of those, maybe, and just say a little bit about what you really hope that your students carry away, how you hope you're benefiting them in that course.
So first, like at the undergraduate level, I welcome every student in my class to do a research project on whatever they want to learn about. That can be something quantitative, even though I'm not a quantoid person. Qualitative, they can interview or they can, you know, conduct a focus group or they can collect interviews on YouTube where we get creative with the methods. I invite them, if they want, to study themselves. Some of the students that we encounter at Parkside, really or anywhere, like if they've got some unresolved things that I think that they could really benefit from knowing more about. So for example, if people are adopted and they're really struggling with some identity issues, if people are maybe in abusive situations where they really need to read something that somebody studied that's really going to open their eyes about something. Like I had a young woman who lived in a family and she wrote about her experience and it became very clear to me that she suffered a kind of what I would call like working class neglect. So that the way that they spoke with her and the way that they didn't really interact with her at home because of work, because of things, she had some needs that she really, you know, didn't understand why she was feeling whatever. Anyway, I introduced her to the concept of neglect, which I was introduced to by somebody. It was a dietitian at one of the universities that I had attended.
Mm-hmm.
And so I welcome them to study whatever's going on. But I let them make their own choices because I would never force anybody to do anything. Mm. And the thing that I hope that they walk away with is they learn about the process of how people with fancy degrees claim to know things.
Mm.
So we don't just sit around in these circles, you know, drinking coffee or other things and come up with these fancy ideas.
Mm.
We actually conceive of the idea and then devise a method to collect information to see exactly if what we think pans out with what we've collected. Mm-hmm. And then we come to terms, you know, through sources and whatnot to make sense of that.
Nice. So in a way you've described two different worlds, you know, what those academics do to create knowledge and what we do on an everyday basis, maybe more phenomenologically. So another question that seems to come out of that for me is, so I'm graduating from UW Parkside. Adrian has taught me about how these academics construct knowledge. Can I and do I want to just leave that at the door at Parkside as I go to my job wherever, or is this something I'll be carrying with me? And if so, how?
Well, I like to think, I don't want to say that we're sneaky at the old communication department at UW Parkside. However, all of the skills that you or that I not just me, but everybody in our department, all of the skills that we deploy in our courses, I would categorize as essential public relations skills. And that is gathering information from publics or from customers or from whatever you want to call them, right? Some kind of stakeholder group. Going to get actual sources where you learn about something that you're dealing with, right? That other people have studied, that other people have information for you to understand. And you learn to create surveys, you learn to interview, you learn to write on an academic level, you learn to analyze things as opposed to summarizing things. And you learn, you know, how to write, hopefully on a level that, you know, is at least at the college level. And any business will benefit from that. If you go out and want to start your own business, if you're a hot dog salesperson and you have a cart, you will be responsible for doing all of your own marketing and PR work. These skills that we teach in the comm department are universal and transferable and will benefit anybody in a capitalist system.
Wow, I'm sold. Where do I sign up? Yeah.
I'll be here all week.
So, yeah, it sounds like you're talking about a strong sense of context, a strong sense of audience, and an ability to think critically and to have some of the tools that one needs in order to communicate effectively within all that matrix.
And communicate effectively in a professional and personal context, because you can't have one without the other.
So, yeah. So maybe talk a little bit more about the personal context or the what transcends the personal professional context, just communication writ large. Like what do you want your students to carry away?
Oh, so this may be too too spiritually deep for this particular show. However, this this is really what I think.
Okay.
I don't think that people are born without purpose. Like, if I don't think that you're accidentally thrown out of your mother's vagina just for the giggles of it all, right? So if you're born, I believe that you have a purpose. And I believe that it's extremely easy through all of the stuff that we deal with socially, interpersonally, social media wise, to learn how sort of to ignore it or get detracted from it. And of course, to learn how to dislike ourselves. That seems to be one of the easiest things that all of us learn. One of the things that I don't think that we teach in college on a regular basis is how to understand yourself. When you get to college, you know, you're reading about the other or studying the other or, you know, some object or some whatever. And I think it's important that you learn a little bit to study and know yourself. Because if you don't do that, then I think it's going to be extremely difficult for you to figure out what you think your purpose is. And that's the key.
Okay. So this is very interesting. So I'm a student in your class, and, or maybe I'm just me because now I'm intrigued. Maybe I could benefit from this. It's not too late for me, is it, Adrian? It's not too late
for anybody. And I don't want to, I don't want to steal the idea of what I just said. I don't want to be, you know, sort of like an accidental plagiarizer. But I got this idea about this purpose thing from James Hill. I think his name is James Hillman, who wrote the book, The Soul's Code. And that book really opened my eyes and gave me a wonderful idea about how he believes that we choose our parents.
We choose our parents. Could you explain that?
Yeah, it's called the Acorn Theory. And please, James Hillman, if you're still alive, don't get mad at me for screwing up your theory here. But he believes that, let's just say, you know, before you're born, you sort of choose your own parents. And once your parents come together and have you, they're giving you actual sort of like the essential knowledge and skills that you will require for whatever your purpose is. Now, this really can get sort of muddy because you could say, well, I was in an abusive home. You know, what's the good in that? Well, this isn't really about good or bad. It's about the things that you're faced with and how you respond and learn about those things. So I could say, well, you know, my mom died when I was young. That's pretty terrible. Yeah, it was terrible. But I have to tell you that if my mother never died, I don't think I'd have a PhD to this day.
Mm.
Wow. You know, so yeah, so I've been given all these challenges. How have I responded? What skills have I developed because of my response? And how does that help me to fulfill my purpose?
So this sounds like a very empowering perspective that is about embracing all of your life, both your tragedies and your gifts, and seeing that as inevitable, as who you were meant to be.
Yeah.
And not rejecting yourself in any way or any of your own experience.
Right.
Not lamenting it, really, and using it.
Yeah, it's easy to hate yourself, you know, and this turns it around and says, you've got these challenges. What are you going to do about it? If you have these challenges, there's something innate within you that you can handle this.
Mm. And that innate, what is that thing that's innate within us that can handle
it? If I knew that, I would have written a book about it and been wealthy. I don't know. you know, I don't know. Attitude, spirit, soul.
There's some faith involved here.
Yes.
So I'm a student in your class, and I want to know myself better, and I want to know what my purpose is. How do you help me do that?
Well, you know, I think that everybody has a different sort of process or method of finding that. Mm-hmm. I didn't find it till I was, after I was 30. So I get some of these people, you know, and they're younger. So I'm not promising big payoffs here. I just start with that it's important to listen to your inner voice, because that, I think, is the clue right there. Mm. You think the thoughts that you do for a particular reason. That reason has everything to do with the things that you should be listening to. And again, this inner voice, it's not always right. You know, sometimes my inner voice wants a cigarette really, really bad. Mm. Not a good decision for me. Mm. However, there are moments in time where that inner voice is extremely clear and tells you in your gut exactly what you want and need. And I think that that's important for you to train yourself to listen to it.
Mm.
And be able to discern, you know, when you should be listening to it.
Would you be all right with talking a little bit more about inner voices?
Sure.
Okay. So before we do that, this is WGTDFM. I am your host, Jonathan Shaler. This is Education Matters, and we are interviewing Professor Adrian Viramontes, communication professor at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. We've covered a lot of topics so far, and right now we're into a really interesting one, the idea of knowing who you are and finding your purpose and relating to these inner voices that we have that may be supportive, may not be supportive.
And I think the calm discipline, we would call those having an inner dialogue.
Inner dialogue.
Or isn't there a phrase? Maybe I'm mixing up the phrase.
That sounds right. Yep. And we sometimes refer to it as intrapersonal communication, in contrast to interpersonal communication. I've been reading some stuff by Leonard Riskin, who does some conflict analysis stuff, and he draws from another theory, which is internal family systems theory. I don't know if you've come across that one, but it's based on the idea that our consciousness, you had mentioned that earlier in our discussion, we just have a base level open consciousness that is pretty healthy. It's a good thing. And we also have all these internal voices. That's why I wanted to come back to that. And do you think we have multiple internal voices?
I don't know. Maybe people do. I'm going to say I think I just have one, and it's been pretty much the same one since I was very young. I just read a study because I'm actually trying to write this paper about how I think that the soul is a process, and it's about cultivating one's voice. And I think that the inner voice is. Anyway, that's another story for another day. But what was I just trying to say?
Inner voices. Is there one or many?
I just read a study about how there are people that have been studied, I think, by psychologists about how they interact with their inner voice. Mm. Some people are able to actually have conversations with that, with mm-hmm. these voices. I don't know that I'm at that level that I can do that, but I believe that people are reporting that they have had different varying experiences with what we will call an inner voice. Mm. And I think depending on how, I don't know how, you know, I don't want to say spiritual you are, but how either well you know yourself or how advanced you are with your own thinking, that, you know, that might explain why some people hear a conversation or can have that, and other people just hear their inner voice, you know, sort of grunting along.
I see. Yeah. So, you know, a high degree of self-awareness is involved here.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we could go on and on about that one. What else would you like to talk about?
I just want to say one thing, because I feel like I don't want to misrepresent the, okay. you know, my view on teaching and learning. I believe that it's possible to have teachers that you absolutely hate, and that's okay. And disliking or not liking them, I think, is just as important as, you know, being enamored or, you know, having great respect for some. We have to learn, again, people that we like and dislike, we learn from those things, I think, sort of equally important things. And so not all of my students, you know, I'm sure like me or think that, you know, that I have a lot to offer. And the ones that don't, I'm just as fine with as the ones that are willing to explore and want to learn stuff about themselves. Mm. I mean, I have students all the time who want to do, you know, that basic study about do we communicate with our pets, and, you know, that kind of level stuff. And I think that that's great. And you want to learn about that, I'm going to be right along the ride with you. Mm.
That's an area I'm interested in, actually. We love cats.
I think that's wonderful. I think that, again, I think animals do communicate with us. Mm-hmm. Beyond domestic pets, I do believe that all of the animals that we often don't even see have ways of communicating with us. I actually have an ongoing conversation with a chipmunk who lives in my garage.
Do you?
Yeah, I believe so, yes. Well, you know, he or she hangs out in my garage and really enjoys the area where I keep the bird seed. Anyway, so we've had this, you know, ongoing, I don't know the gender of this chipmunk, but, you know, we have conversations, and I think that there's a thing there.
Oh, that's very interesting.
I know I sound silly, but
maybe there's an academic paper there. I don't know.
I don't think that there is. But no. What I'm saying is, okay, I think that objects even communicate. So, you know, so I know I can sound like I'm way out there. Mm. But the way that we interact with things, I believe, is much more involved than we often give it credit for.
Mm. The world is suffused with meaning.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, so back to students finding their voice. That seems to be really central to who you are and your whole approach to teaching.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about what you've seen and what your experience has been in terms of students finding their own voice?
You know, I've had I've had students who even the littlest things that they study can open up an entire world. So I've had students of color who were feeling very confused about whether they should have white friends or not, you know? I've had students who've shown up not knowing how to use periods and commas. Mm-hmm. And so I've spent, you know, independent studies with them, teaching them basic grammar just so that they, when they leave, you know, they could get a job and not have to worry about those things. Mm-hmm. And again, other students, I just think that I like to tell them of what I think are the secrets of sort of going to college that often never get discussed. Again, like, you know, and I keep repeating myself, and I guess I feel bad about this, but it's so easy to distrust ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to believe that we're not as smart as the next person. And the problem, which I draw a lot of attention to, is one of the things that I think that really affects us as a society is that capitalism is great and good. Of course, it has some bad things too. However, one of the things that I think that it teaches us to do, which is not the best idea, is to hierarchize everything. Think about things in terms of what, you know, competition. We often think about racial categories as a hierarchy, right? So, the worst is the darker you could be, right? The more sort of low on the hierarchy that you are. We think about these things, I think, because of the structure of capitalism. I think that we need to make decisions about some things with our heart and not our understanding of supply and demand.
So you've mentioned capitalism a few times now. This is very interesting to me because, you know, we all have our disciplinary silos, communication, economics, political science, and you're kind of crossing those lines in talking about communication, which I think is a good thing. I think interdisciplinarity is what we need, and divisions between academic disciplines are artificial. They allow some for some focus, right, and some deep study, but at the same time, if we don't make these connections, we're missing a huge amount. So can you say any more about capitalism, individualism?
Here's what really opened my eyes to it. When I was writing my dissertation, and I was actually trying to find out how a third generation Mexican American, that would be me, raised by immigrant Mexican grandparents, could believe that I was white for 30 years. Like that, when I realized that that was the essence of my experience, I had to do a lot to figure out how that could possibly happen. So one of the ways that I did it was, when you do phenomenology, that means that you study absolutely every condition that makes possible your reality or that particular situation. One of the conditions that I had to study was the fact that I was from Gary, Indiana. Yeah, so one of the areas that I had to learn about in order to even understand myself was the role of the economic force that brought my family from Mexico to the United States. And that was the steel mills of Gary, Indiana. One of the things that I learned that really opened my eyes to the larger way that the system shapes us is that during the 1920 strike, most of the Southern European workers who were originally in this area, they went on strike because of the working conditions. And so what did Inland Steel do? Well, they went to Mexico to go get a bunch of Mexicans, right, to come here and do the work for them. So as the Mexican people crossed is it called a scab line? I'm not even sure. The picket line, right? They crossed the picket line.
They were scabs, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to go into work. That's what began the very negative feelings between the group that was on strike and the Mexican immigrants that came here. They were drawn here by the executives at the steel mill because the mill had to keep going, right? They had to keep making a profit. So they brought Mexican people in. That's what started the conflicts that led to all other things like, oh, these immigrants, they're sick, they're costing us money. Oh, these immigrants, they're stealing our jobs. Oh, these, when the real reason for the conflict was because of the steel mill. And again, this need to make profit. So and by the way, organizations benefit when people of different racial categories don't get along. And again, I love capitalism. It makes everything possible in our reality here. But it's important to understand the dark and the light of capitalism.
So I bet probably we don't have time for this today, but you could talk about reforms necessary.
Oh, I don't know that I could. Capitalism. I just think it's important to understand.
Well, that's an implication. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think it's really, really important to understand that being able to buy stuff is not an innocent thing.
Yeah.
You know, it really affects us.
In so many ways. And also what you were saying about the economic basis of racism reminds me of Tion van Dijk's research. He, in his book, Communicating Racism, he talks about how one huge engine perpetuating racism is when privileged folk, white folk, have conversations, tell stories in which people of color are characterized as cultural threats, social threats, and economic threats. And that's it.
And I want to just add to that and say that it's that my Mexican family was extremely racist. I'm not saying this as something prideful. I'm trying to be very honest that everybody can be prejudiced and speak in racist ways. And my Mexican family was taught that primarily based on, how it affected the area that we lived in and understood it. You know, it was easier to blame, let's say, a group of people for something as opposed to thinking, well, that the person that, you know, a lot of the executives that run all of these businesses, again, benefit from us thinking this way.
So your grandparents.
I'm not trying to say that they're evil. I'm just saying right. that the system works in a particular way. We don't right. control everything, and that's how it sort of tumbles out in the wash.
So people of color can be motivated to be racist in order to survive in the economic system they find themselves in. For example, your grandparents telling you you're white.
Yeah.
Did I connect the dots correctly or is that off?
You know, I don't know if that's correct or not. I just, I think it's important that we talk about how all of us are capable of being prejudiced about something or some group. I think racism happens in contexts of power. Where if you have the power to give somebody a job or the power to arrest somebody or the power, right, to affect somebody's trajectory, and then you employ your prejudice and make a decision, I think that that's a more sort of distinct form of racism than the fact that absolutely all of us have feelings and prejudices about some group or another.
Right.
And how you behave and act on that, that's a different story, you know, in a different level.
Right.
But I think that I think that a lot of us, for some reason, I don't know, no offense, Oprah Winfrey, but people of color can be racist. It's possible. I come from a family that is that way, or that was that way. Most of them are dead. But I'm just, we need to stop pretending that that doesn't happen.
Why do you bring up Oprah?
Because I, for some reason, thought that Oprah, when she had her show, used to sort of pretend that people of color really couldn't be racist. And again, if you have power and you have the ability to make a decision that affects the trajectory of somebody's life, I think that that enables us, anybody, to be able to make a kind of move or decision that could be considered racist.
So if you exercise power within a certain sphere, large or small, you can be racist within that sphere.
Yes. And again, the way that we use racist is like, you know, like I'm wearing this costume, I'm racist today. I don't think it works that way. I think that sometimes the way we speak has been ingrained with racist sentiment, if you will.
Mm.
And some of us who speak and don't even know that we're invoking that.
Mm.
I think that racism is much more nuanced than how we often speak of it or treat it. And again, that's why I think telling sort of the secrets of the things that we've experienced in our families is so much more important than I think that we give any really credit to.
Mm. Kind of airing out our own laundry.
Yeah. Again, and that's some shadow work, if you will. Everybody's got shadow and light. And if you never talk about your shadow stuff, then it gains more power.
Mm.
I stole that from somebody too, but I have no idea who that is.
Yeah, I hear you. I think about understanding our own trauma, because I think that everybody lives with trauma, has been traumatized early on, yes, and multiple times, and
yes,
to understand that, to not feel shame about that is a journey, right? And to work with that.
And what I mean, this is sort of off the topic, but I wanted to revisit that. Another thing that I think we do thinking in hierarchies is we treat trauma like it's a competition. So, you know, like the Mexicans have suffered this and that sort of oppression. And then I'm in a conversation with somebody else and somebody else says, yeah, but it's not worse than, you know, being in a Holocaust. Mm. This is not something that we're competing against. There is no winner. Mm. We don't win anything by having the most oppressive stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that that's another realm of dangerous thought that we need to rethink and retrace the way that we talk about it.
And one of the things that I hear in that is that we all suffer from intergenerational trauma. That,
yes,
your trauma didn't start the day you were born. You inherited a lot.
Yeah.
We all do. Yeah. And this is not just through our family specifically, but also through the culture that we live within, shared cultural history.
Yeah.
Although we don't share it in the same way, and that's important to note. Yeah.
Do you think I sound wacky?
Not at all. This is deep stuff and it's good stuff. I think one of the things I love about talking with you is that you always bring me into a very profound subject area where I want to continue thinking about it. And that's a sign of a great teacher, I think.
Oh, wow. That's very kind of you.
Well, it's true. And you've been recognized for that. And I think you should continue to be. So on that note, we're getting down to the wire here, about 1 minute. Well, actually, we had a stall earlier on, so maybe we have almost 2 minutes. But what I wanted to ask you is, if this was your graduate, I don't want to put this pressure on you, but I was going to say, if this was your last day of class, and you only had a minute before everyone was going to leave, what would you want to say to your students?
You know, honestly, I would want to say that every day, here's what I really think. And I just told them this a couple of weeks ago at the beginning of the semester. I think you should challenge yourself to spend 10 minutes with yourself without a phone, without a screen, without anything on, and just to see what you think. And let yourself think all of the crappy things that you try to avoid thinking about, or just to see what comes out. Just 10 minutes. If you can find time to do that, I think that will improve a lot about your daily life. And another thing that I believe, that no matter what your goals are or whatever, you need to spend some moments in every day actually enjoying something.
Mm.
You know? Like, go outside and listen to, you know, something interesting, the birds sing, or, you know, during the pandemic, that's the one thing that I was able to experience that I have to say really positively affected me. And I think that everybody should at least try to do that.
That's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much, Professor Adrian Viramontes of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. This has been Education Matters with Jonathan Shaler. Have a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at wgtd.org.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. A trusted resource since 1999, the ADRC is a no-cost, one-stop shop for older people, adults with disabilities, and their families. For more information, call 262-605-6646. from the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar. Going on Medicare? The Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center offers no-cost, unbiased Medicare workshops for those new to Medicare or those wanting to learn more. For more info, contact the ADRC at 262-605-6646.
This is WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's hosted by Jane.